Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the third webcast of the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. The date is February 10, 2007, and it is 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you're listening to the program live, there will be an opportunity to call in towards the end of the show with a question or a comment. The dial-in number is on your computer screen. If you know of anyone who'd like to hear this broadcast later on, it is going to be in the archive section of the site, blogtalkradio.com, under Water Fuel Museum, following the show by at least an hour. Tonight's guest is Chris Patton. Chris is an independent film director and an executive producer with a Hollywood production company called Dark Horse Entertainment. This is the team that brought you such films as The Mask with Jim Carrey, Mystery Men, Time Cop, Alien vs. Predator, and more recently, Hellboy. Chris has been directing documentaries on advanced environmental technologies since 1996 and used to work with the International Tesla Society. He consulted for many years as a science advisor to studios and has a background in international finance as well as mining engineering. Now, the reason for including a person with credentials such as his in this program is that Chris has documented several different types of water fuel technology in particular, as well as other alternative energy technologies. So we'd like to welcome him to the show, and let's see if Chris is not with us. Chris, are you there?
James, I'm here.
Oh, great. Last week we had a no-show due to some unforeseen circumstances, so I'm very happy to have you with us tonight.
Well, thank you.
And you're talking to us from California, is that not so?
It's semi-sunny Los Angeles, California.
Okay, great. Well, let's see now. We have a lot to talk about in an hour, so I guess we can get right to some of the most interesting things that you've witnessed personally and documented on film. Maybe you could just start out by telling us when you got interested in alternative energy technology.
You bet. I've actually been interested in environmental and alternative technology since the mid-80s. I was a big avid reader of science fiction growing up, and every now and then I would read something about, perpetual motion or the future of water cars or something interesting where you'd read an old popular science article from 1935 and they'd show the hovering cars flying through the sky running on water. There was always some kind of interesting aspect of that to me that it was real. And I didn't know if it would ever be real, but I always thought, you know, it's worth pursuing. Someday somebody might have an answer to some of these things, and they can't be completely fanciful. So as I finished up college and I worked my way through Army Corps of Engineers and eventually got into investment banking, I sort of followed off the exotic pursuits of looking for, UFOs and hovering cars and anti-gravity, and I started focusing a little bit more on environmental technologies that I thought would really, really be beneficial. And I'm from the Pacific Northwest, Portland, Oregon, and when you read a lot of the environmental magazines that were coming out at the time, a lot of them were really stressing, like Mother Earth News and things like that, used to really stress solar panels. Everybody had solar panels. And then, you know, you're from Portland, Oregon, and you're reading these articles going, everybody doesn't live in Arizona.
Yeah.
we all don't live in Southern California. I'm up here, and there's 8 months of misty skies and rain. There's got to be another answer. So it started spiking my interest. As I started doing investment banking, I started looking, just as sort of a hobby, started looking around the planet because I could afford to, for other exotic methods of power generation or beneficial environmental technologies. And every now and then, I'd get a little whisper of something. I was doing some commercial financing for shrimp ships at sea over in Asia. And when I was talking to this gentleman, he mentioned that he was working on some mining projects over in Africa that had these diesel motors that were running on single cylinders, and they were using something like 80% water and 20% diesel or diesel combination with corn oil or something. I thought, nah, there's no way. But this guy was somebody that I really respected as an engineer, and he told me that he had been using them himself. So I knew it was probably real. I just couldn't imagine how it could be real. So that kind of logged into the back of my mind, and I actually went over to West Africa to start a gold and diamond exploration company over in the Ivory Coast, and I kind of got caught up in that whole Liberian Civil War that kicked over in 96.
Wow.
But while I was there, I noticed some really interesting things. The less these people had available to them, I mean the mining engineers and the civilians and the people that lives in the tribes way out in the bush, the more innovative they got. And I mean, some of these people were using some really, really, really smart environmental strategies to keep the water in the villages inside these containment systems built out of gourds that were also being used to as weight systems for, everything from counterweights to hoisting people out of mining holes to using the water as a, what would you call it? You can change the pH of the water to make it a disinfectant. They would ozonate it using solar panels and electricity, and they'd have disinfected water and clean drinking water. And they would also turn some of this into hydrogen, and they were using some of the hydrogen off to power up some of the generators. And I didn't even know this stuff was possible. And I was in the middle of West Africa watching these people power up with all these really interesting, necessary alternative energies. And it really started striking home to me. I was over there for a couple of years that we've really taken so much for granted because we haven't been forced into using these alternative methods, these really smart methods. We've gotten really used to crutching ourselves on oil dependencies and being used to having power all the time and the lights go on whenever you want to come on. So I had a real reality shift when I moved to West Africa in the mid-90s. When I came home after the Liberian Civil War, I had a bit of a life change because I went over there because I was going to make my fortune mining gold and diamonds to come back here and bring back some of the technologies I found, but also to finance and develop environmental technologies. Well, the situation didn't go well for me over there because the Civil War stripped me of all my money, killed my partners, and destroyed my business. So basically what I came back with was just a knowledge of what I'd seen. So taking what little cash I had left, I decided, you know what? I'm going to find all these technologies. There's got to be some really good suppressed technologies out there. So I took every dime I had left, I liquidated my assets, I sold my properties, and I traveled around the planet for about 6 years. And I started doing documentaries on suppressed environmental technologies and naturopathic remedies for chronic diseases. And then I became involved with the International Tesla Society towards the around 1996, and I actually started covering scientists and engineers who had really outlandish fringe science environmental technologies that defied explanation but could be demonstrated.
Can you name a couple of them?
Yeah. The first documentary that I did is I followed a gentleman named Paul Pantone, and he had a technology called the GEET device, which stands for Global Environmental Energy Technology. And what intrigued me most about this device, and it's since then, there's been a wash of criticism about this guy and the technology on the Internet. At the time, here's what was going on. I was following him with a professor from UCLA and two engineers from BYU. Now, what was interesting is they were telling me, as we were on the road for about 6 months, following him from survival conferences to home and garden shows, he would show up with these Tecumseh generators that were these 5-kilowatt generators, and he would retrofit the exhaust manifold and change it so that he would vaporize the gasoline before it reached the engine, almost doubling or quadrupling its mileage, seemingly, maybe 50%. I'm not sure. It seemed to vary depending on what he was using. But what was really intriguing is he'd somehow created a plasma reactor accidentally where you could get away with using 10 to 20% fuel, and the rest could be whatever liquid was laying around the house as waste.
Hmm.
And it produced practically no emissions, and the exhaust pipe ran cold, which means it was creating an efficient burn. And this was absolutely startling to me. And this,
in other words, he had come up with more than one type of device. When we say GEET, it includes everything he's done?
Well, actually, what he started to do is he started taking on other technologies from other inventors unsuccessfully because he wasn't really able to really pitch his own stuff that successfully. He was great at demonstrations, but he could never really mass market his technology because he never really it's the fault of most artists and engineers that they never really hire on the right team to promote their good works properly. And he fell into the same category as somebody who could really demonstrate his stuff well and really took people by surprise and could consistently get the same result but had no idea how to market his stuff. So Global Environmental Energy Technology originally was formed to take in all these advanced technologies similar to his and create a worldwide network by selling licenses to people in every state and every country. Well, after a couple of years, he realized he was just too overwhelmed to sell other people's technologies, and he was stuck with his one device. But what was really intriguing is this one device alone had so many oddball phenomena coming along with it that it led into three areas of study, just in terms of trying to figure out what it was doing. Some theories were it was electrochemical. Another theory was it was a self-inducing plasma field that was able to break down any liquid that was going into it into its constituent noble gases. And then a final one was it was a thermal reactor that was breaking things down because the vacuum of the engine was pulling the liquids towards the carburetor and the exhaust was going out. So let me give you a configuration example. It's going to be hard to understand what I'm talking about unless I explain probably what it is. Inside, here's what he did. He had a cast iron pipe that was about, I'd say, 6 to 8 inches long. And in the middle of that cast iron pipe, he placed a steel rod right down the center that was spaced from the edges by 1/8 of an inch. Now, he put that inside the exhaust manifold. So what happened was when your engine was drawing fuel, it would draw it into this cast iron pipe around this steel rod. And the steel rod was in the exhaust manifold. So the exhaust coming out was, I guess, what, 400 to 500 degrees plus cold fuel coming in. What happens is you create this electrostatic charge on the steel rod that would almost turn it into a plasma reaction that would break the liquids and gases down almost atomically as soon as that engine got hot enough. So when you fired it up, it would choke for a minute because it wasn't hot enough to create the reaction. Once it was warmed up after 30 seconds, you could essentially pull the gas tank off the system, like we did in many conferences, and pour pickle juice, beer, used motor oil, anything you had on hand down that engine, and we'd hold this white rag up, and as we were talking, he would hold it onto the back of the tailpipe. And after his 20-minute talk, he would hold it up, and there'd be no black carbon on that handkerchief.
Wow.
I mean, it was extraordinary. And following this around for a couple of years pretty much opened my eyes to the fact that nobody really knew anything about anything. We've barely scratched the surface about what we think we know. We've got certain ideas about what we understand in classical physics. But every time I would see a professor or a physicist or an engineer or these Chinese engineers or these Japanese physicists come up to Paul, each one with their own theory. After 2 years, years of this, I'm thinking, nobody has a clue. It's a cast iron pipe and a steel rod, and there's 60 theories, and it's doing the same thing. Nobody has a clue. And it's a hydrogen reactor / atomic reactor / plasma reactor. So after that really signed and sealed it for me. After this demonstration, even though we couldn't quite ever figure out exactly what it was doing, it was creating a repeatable effect. He was able to sell these things. He would sell these generators for $1,000 a pop. You'd go to the survival conference, buy it, take it home, and pray that when Y2K came around, you weren't forced to use your own urine as fuel.
Yeah, well, you know, just to point out something, there is a posting on the, this is the Free Energy News website.
Sure.
Saying that there's some confirmation. It says Los Alamos plasma in Geet's shadow mentions that there's some mainstream documentation now of what Paul Pantone has been promoting for years.
Isn't that funny?
And it says for which he is presently incarcerated.
Yeah, this is kind of. Yeah, that's one of the reasons. I'll give you a good example. If you're ever arrested by the Utah police, don't tell them you can run your engines on water. It'll probably get you put into a mental institution.
That happens.
he's now sort of in the mental ward.
I can't believe it.
It's unfortunate. It was a combination of events. You know, he had some personal issues, some personal lifestyle issues that got him into trouble, and unfortunately, ego overcame his intelligence when he got into court, and he thought he would impress everybody by making some not exaggerated claims, but some fairly accurate claims about what his system could do, and they should release him right away because he needs to help save the world. And of course, that got him an instant one-way ticket to an insane asylum and probably an additional couple years incarceration.
Wow.
It's unfortunate because he was probably – Paul's a good friend of mine, so I can say this. Paul, if you're out there, buddy, I'm sorry you're at where you're at. But a lot of inventors are their own worst enemies. Unfortunately, you know, they tend to over-exaggerate in order to get capital every now and then. And it's to them, it's not enough that we're amazed at the extraordinary results that they're already getting. Sometimes they push it over the top a little bit in order to impress people to raise money. He never really had to, which is what was really startling to me. He went over the top a few times in his explanation or his examples of how the system worked, but his system was so extraordinary every time he demonstrated it that it didn't really require any additional exaggeration on his part.
Interesting. Now, there is a county commissioner from Maryland who has replicated Paul's GEAT system.
Was he successful?
Yeah, and I think he's going to be joining us toward the end of this program.
I asked him
if he'd like to call in, and because he's a participant in some of the Yahoo chat groups about water fuel, and he goes by the name Bassman because he plays bass in a local band there occasionally. Fortunately, tonight he's not gigging, so.
Perfect.
We can look forward to hearing from Larry.
That's great.
Okay, so GEAT was one thing that you saw back in, you're saying around 1996 is when
That was about 1996, and then I started crossing over a little bit more into the Tesla technology. So I started following up on claims of extraordinary magnitude where people were able to keep batteries charged by self-charging them with unique components or electronic systems that were radiant energy receivers or ambient energy antennas. Or, for example, they would be able to energize themselves and keep themselves running while offering up additional power, so you could power your house with a self-sustaining power supply. So I began following these systems around the planet, and there were quite a few claims. This was kind of like the Art Bell arc was really at its all-time high. It was a kind of a combination of everybody was talking about UFOs, free energy, over-unity technologies, and extraordinary science. And I sort of, at the time, was on the cusp of that because I was the guy documenting those claims for radio people, radio personalities, and for the International Tesla Society. So I was on the front line. Every time a new phone call would come in, I'd be in my Batmobile racing across the planet trying to find out who, what, where, when, and why, and if it was legitimate. And I was fortunate enough to have some really bright people come along with me on occasion that had a lot of experience in alternative energy and fringe science, and they would come out there to validate or invalidate the claims or say that, you know, it's interesting, but it's unusable, or it's interesting, and it's not quite up to snuff, but it's a phenomenon worth keeping your eye on. And while I was on that track, a good friend of mine, or somebody I became good friends with, was George Wiseman, who owns Eagle Research. And at the time, he was up in southern Canada, or northern Canada, northern United States, southern Canada, I think is the area. And he was in a mining colony, and he was doing a lot of Brown's Gas research. And Brown's Gas later became known, or I'm sorry, prior to that was Rhodes Gas. And Brown's gas, in case some of your listeners aren't familiar, was a form of hydrogen that was created uniquely by pulsing an electrolyzer with a square wave instead of a sine wave. Standard electrolysis was normally done for the last, 120 years, 140 years, just taking a current and running it through a couple of plates through water, and you would get what would be known as common electrolysis. Well, a guy named Ewell Brown back in the late 60s in Australia started fiddling around with the idea that maybe he could get some fuel enhancements by increasing the amount of hydrogen you could get from standard electrolysis. So he started screwing around with different waveforms of energy, and he started using a pulsed square wave. And this square wave, under a certain amount, and when the water is held under a certain amount of pressure, came up with this interesting combination gas that was hydrogen-oxygen that was, they called a stoichiometric mix, which means it's an interesting combination mix of both. But here's what was intriguing about it. It was a flame that was less than 230 degrees, but would vaporize just about anything known to man. It wouldn't burn your hand, and it wouldn't boil water. And I spent a great deal of time up in this mining colony with George and his team. He was hired by a mining group to use Brown's gas to sift copper and gold away from minerals and quartz. And the unique thing that Brown's gas did is it's basically just a big bucket of water that you electrolyze with a pulse square wave, and you get this long, invisible lightsaber-like flame that'll come out at 200 degrees, but it will crisp rock and cause it to melt and sort of like flake away like a liquid. It starts to break up and it sort of starts to dissolve, and then it turns back into its constituent parts again, but heavy metals would just drip away from the rock.
Wow.
So you wouldn't sear anything. There wouldn't be a lot of pollution, and there's no chemical leaching, and you could get rid of the arsenics and all this other garbage to pull the metals out of the stones.
Are they still mining gold this way?
You know what? I have no idea, because it was a limited contract for a limited amount of time, and I think his job was just to find out how far could you push Brown's gas. And while he was up there, he was trying to continue forward with Ewell Brown's research to find out could you get a car or an engine to run on water. So when I was up there, we at the time couldn't get his 1974 Ford LTD to run completely on water. And I think that had a lot more to do with the inefficiency of a 1974 Ford LTD than it did with his hydrogen boosters. But he was able to get amazing amounts of efficiency by just adding water that was electrolyzed into this unique form of hydrogen that would give them a 20 to 40% increase in fuel economy and would reduce emissions by nearly 80 to 90%.
So he was toying with hydrogen boosters back in the mid-90s then?
Actually, even earlier, back in the early 90s.
Okay.
And he kind of just became louder and more public about it because he started going to the International Tesla Society and a few environmental conferences and started demonstrating Brown's gas on site, because it was a bit of an urban legend. And there was 1,001 things that people said you could do with it that weren't true. So he would show up with a real Brown's gas torch and say, okay, I know you all heard that you can weld crystal to gold to steel and aluminum and a nail together with Brown's gas. It's not true. But what it does uniquely is it will melt any metal and it will weld any metal. And some of the unique properties is the energy isn't spent in the flame like in a hydrogen flame that's 5,000 degrees. The energy potential is spent once the gas comes in contact with the hardened material. So you've got a flame that's about 200 degrees. When it hits like a piece of tungsten that requires 10,500 degrees, it then reacts with the metal, and it will vaporize that metal. So all the energy potential is used on contact instead of the creation of the flame.
Okay, so you did some documentary work with George then.
Quite a bit, yeah.
People are watching now when they get Brown's gas videos are your work, huh?
Some of these are my work. Yeah, if you've seen Brown's gas Geet devices, a Don Smith device, Bob Beck, naturopathic remedies for chronic diseases, Hulda Clark's cure for cancer. These are all my documentaries. They've been out since about 1996. They've been piecemealed by a lot of companies and inserted into other projects on Discovery Channel over the years, and eventually they've all sort of made their way, I've noticed, onto the internet in little, what do you call them, G-movies.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, all these little YouTubes all over the place.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good, and that means you've contributed to people's enlightenment with regard to the possibilities.
I hope so. I thought I was carrying on the education that I was getting as I was traveling, and I have no problem with people posting these documentaries online. I really don't, because I think expanding the knowledge will inspire and generate a lot more people to come forward with the interesting and unique technologies they probably are sitting on, and they just need a little inspiration to kind of push it out.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the advance in film technology, is that almost everyone is carrying with them a cell phone that's a camera.
Yeah.
And even a video camera.
It's true.
And we can instantly post images to the internet so that the whole world can see them.
it makes it a fairly unique era in trying to hide something, doesn't it?
It really does. it means that those of us who are tinkering with alternative energy technology can, if we are inclined to do so out of wanting to, you know, enlighten others and try to help people to realize that the current paradigm is not the way it is because there's nothing else out there. It's that way because a few powerful people decided it would be this way, and they're long dead. This happened decades ago. And now we're sort of trapped in a paradigm that they started, initiated, and then, like you say, academia is telling us that there is nothing else.
Right. That's the biggest problem I've noticed, that, you know, because everybody seems to want to help, even guys that I work with on an international banking level and even people in some oil companies that I know at the very high level, they all seem to have a fairly good heart. But what will happen is this: every time somebody brings a really unique and interesting technology to market that may have a substantial impact on economy or the environment, they always have to have a science advisor, some third-party guy come in there and check off on the science to a business plan in order for money to be raised. And unfortunately for these engineers, a lot of these guys either A, don't understand the science, B, they think they understand it, but they can't explain it, or C, they're a little bit jealous that somebody has come up with a new solution that sort of defies any explanation that they can come up with, and it's better to be safe than sorry, so let's just tell everybody it doesn't work. And I have to say, unfortunately, one of the prime resistance movements in the United States is the patent office. And it's unfortunate because for an inventor, in order to protect himself and in order to protect an investor, you've got to throw a patent on something. And I can tell you, I know for an absolute fact, because I've seen internal memos, I've seen some smoking guns the last 10 years at the from the patent office, from internal documents, that indicate that they have no intention of ever letting anything that has self-sustainability, super high efficiency that seems unusual, anti-gravity, any of those things that if an inventor who actually has, whether it works or not, the patent office is under instruction by internal policy not to grant patents to those. Now, here's why. I want to read you something, but I can't because I've got a non-disclosure on it. But the reason why is they're afraid to be embarrassed, and they're afraid that it could also lead to litigation. Because if they grant a patent on something that is anti-gravity or, let's say, hydrogen on demand, you're able to find a really unique way that somehow is 500% over what Faraday laid in law 120 years ago. And you go to the patent office and you demonstrate it. Well, they're going to go down their manuals and say, well, the numbers don't make sense, but he's doing it. He's right here in front of the office and he's doing it. Well, if we grant this to him and we refuse the grant to 15 other people over the last 20 years, that could be a lot of lawsuits. That could be pretty embarrassing because it means if we have to give this guy a patent, we might also have to grant patents on all these other fringe technologies that we've been denying the last 130 years. And that's a lot of potential lawsuits. It's right up there with dentists refusing to acknowledge that mercury might be poisonous because you've got 400 million people with silver fillings that would be knocking on your door 24 hours later saying, hello, you didn't tell me this would cause cancer and brain damage.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing about that is that the patent office has allowed the patenting of water-fueled devices.
Isn't that funny? Every now and then, about once every 20 years, one kind of slips through.
Yeah, and in fact, my book is full of the reproductions of such patents. So it is a little bit of a curiosity that on the one hand, there are certain things that have been viewed as too threatening to the economy or to the, as you say, litigation, whatever, and yet they have allowed numerous water fuel patents, such as those by Stan Meyer,
right.
Exogen, Henry Dad Garrett being the 1934 water carburetor that was patented. These are things that did get through the system, and I'm really glad that the patent office documentation is such that any of us can access these for free online. In fact, I prefer the free online patent site as to the U.S. Patent and Trade Office because it's easier to navigate through.
I agree.
But
let me tell you what's really unique about your book. Here's what I love about your water car book, and this is really something. I was on the road. I'm working with some projects right now. I work with a company called Dark Horse Entertainment, which is a division of Dark Horse Comics, which is the third largest comic book company in the world, next to Marvel and DC. They've got an entertainment division, and we did The Mask and Hellboy and Mystery Men and Time Cop, and they co-produced Alien vs. Predator, and we've got Hellboy 2, and all these wonderful projects coming out. And here I am inside. I sort of see over the independent film division, and there's only three of us in there. And I've got this bent on environmental technology, and I have access to all these industry people and industry money and all that wonderful stuff. And what's really funny is I was pitching your book as a project to the studios as a feature film, as an example of maybe we should do a really interesting story about a guy that's following the advancements of water car technologies from the 1780s all the way up to present time, and he stumbles on a couple of secret technologies, and we'll take it forward and we'll demonstrate it in the film, and maybe we can actually get a couple of these things to work, and we'll put it out as a fictitional piece, wink, 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 and make it look like, this could be possible. And what was really funny is even with physical evidence and videos and the documentation that I've done and your book, it's so outlandish to most people even film people who, I mean, I do science fiction. It's so outlandish for people, even in the studio system, to believe that this is possible, that you just get nodding heads like, no, no, you've got to really fictionalize this or people just won't really believe it because there's just no way. We all wish it were true, but there's just no way. So what that did is it really inspired me, actually, because I thought, you know what, here I've got the evidence. I've got James's water car book, and what I did is I took a bunch of pieces out of your water car book, and my favorite section is basically between the 1900 and 1950. It seemed like anything goes. Whatever you had a patent for, they'd pretty much do it if it seemed somewhat reasonable, no matter how outlandish. After the 60s and 70s, you'll notice that the water patents start to become one every 10 years and then one every 20 years, where, you know, back in the day, it seemed like every other day there was somebody putting out a really unique idea towards hydrogen on demand or turning water into instant fuel and maybe adding some chemicals to it to sort of advance it up a little bit. So what I did is I took these pages out and I started doing my own little history of Tesla and radiant energy technologies, and I started putting them side by side with the advancements of hydrogen on demand and water as fuel. And I started looking at the parallels of how things were accepted between the 1860s all the way up to the 1900s to the 1950s, and then the slowdown, and then as the oil crisis starts to go in the 70s, and how the Department of Energy started putting more of a clamp down on what people could say and do. And I just noticed everything started dwindling down to the end. And I thought, you know what? That's actually a far more interesting story than a fictional account of a guy trying to build a water car based on plans he found in the 1930s. Maybe we should just tell everybody, using James's book as a guideline, the actual history of water car research, what's happened to them, and maybe, just maybe, I can get the studios to buck up for a couple of these technologies and we'll demonstrate them in the film.
What a great idea.
And it took less than 24 hours and we were approved on the project and we've been shooting for 8 months.
Wow. That's awesome. That is really awesome. So in the midst of this, you have traveled. I know you traveled across the U.S. because you paid us a visit here, and I think you had been down to see Bob, the famous water fuel device inventor and promoter.
I prefer to call him our hydro savior. This boy has done it, man. If anybody's patched onto the water groups and they're curious about something, and there's always a lot of babble online about who's doing what and what works and what doesn't based on somebody who's not building anything versus people who are building things, and there's always that kind of chatter going back and forth, and it's always impossible to distinguish what a workable technology is based on internet conversation. So sometimes you've just got to slap down the credit card, fly out someplace, sit down face-to-face with the guy, and really find out what he's got going. So I was very fortunate to have Bob allowed me and one of my partners to come down, a friend who used to be the president of the International Tesla Society, and we spent a couple days with him. And I'd had, you know, a fairly extensive knowledge based on my work with Brown's Gas, what electrolyzers could and couldn't do, and it was really tough to phase me. I got to tell you, I was pretty steeled up for having a fairly implausible explanation as to what he might be doing to increase hydrogen efficiency. After sitting with this guy for 45 minutes and really understanding what his background is, and I don't know if he's ever disclosed it, but this guy is one sharp cookie, probably one of the smartest technical engineers I've ever met. He's got a very extensive technical background in microwave energy technology and motorboat racing, hydroplane, or what do you call them? I guess they are the hydroplane
hydrofoil
races.
Or?
Hydrofoil, hydroplane boat races, automobile racing. And he's owned engineering shops, and he's owned electronic businesses, and he's built motors. So he's got a really unique, multi-diverse background. He's not just a guy who is sitting on the fence, going through some old Stan Meyer patents, laying out some plans on a piece of paper, and then complaining on the internet about how things don't work.
Yeah.
This guy was building the stuff before he knew what Brown's Gas was, before he knew what Stan Meyer was, before he knew what any of this stuff was. Back in the 80s, he was running boats on hydrogen, on pure hydrogen. Now, he got stomped on pretty good. Department of Energy came in, got wind that he was doing something to alter the fuel in his boats and probably something else, and I don't know the extent of what he's willing to talk about, but they slapped him pretty good. And they made it very impossible for this guy to come forward with any technology that would be beneficial to mankind because they said, you know, continue forward on this track and you think we're making your life hell now. You just wait. We're making your life hell now and you haven't even disclosed anything to the public. So he was terrified.
Yeah, that's true. He was doing it pretty much in the hush-hush.
He was, yeah. He didn't want to talk to anybody about it, and he does not mention running cars. And he's very smart. And I got to say, on his defense, people push him all the time on the internet. The few that are lucky enough to talk to him about, well, what is the exact configuration that will run my V6? You know, he doesn't run cars. He makes hydrogen boosters. That's what he does, and that's what he used to do for his boats. And people will push him and pull him and demand this and demand that. And you know what? The guy has given so many secrets out that you have no idea what he's actually given you. We've rebuilt his system. I'll tell you this right now. At the studios, Los Angeles, California, we've had limited financing, and we've had a fairly inexperienced engineering team. But between the three teams that we've had put this thing together, I can tell you, this guy's done it. He nailed it. He gave us a gift. And what he did is he showed us a way to split enough hydrogen on demand combined with enough gas, oxygen gas, that we can keep a generator or a motor running with less than 4 amps of energy and I believe like 120 volts, maybe 100 volts of power. And it's enough hydrogen to keep a vehicle running or an engine running. And a lot of people go, oh, wow, I've done the equations on that. That far exceeds Faraday's equation on how much gas and energy goes in. You need to have 40 amps and 700 volts and 300 amps here. And
yeah, right, for the BTU equivalent or something.
Yeah, I keep hearing that. They keep getting these thermal equivalents. But when you're doing something that's closer to quantum mechanics, when you start shaking things at a subatomic level and a molecular level, the laws change. And that's what a lot of guys who really are steadfast to the second law of thermodynamics cling to is classical physics, which is an A equals A equals A, a British thermal, you know, electricity in, British thermal unit out equals this much, because at one time a guy was stirring an ore in a bucket of water, and he said this many calories equals this many times is how I stir my bucket of water. And they've been just frozen onto that because it works for most equations. What throws people is when those equations don't work. Instead of acknowledging that there may be an equation that was missed, they just hang fast to the equation that they know, and they just lock onto it and say, well, if it's not this, it's nothing. And it's too bad for them, because I got to tell you, when you start breaking out of classical physics and you start looking into what quantum physics actually has explained and offered and can demonstrate, you realize that not only have we not even touched the surface, but there are so many levels of energy and so many different ways to tap it that if you can harness it, it's 200 million watts per square foot of space or something of that equivalent. I can't remember the exact number. But it's almost an infinitesimal amount of energy per square footage of space if you can shake it at a subatomic level and exercise and energize it or cause its release or harness its release. Now, what this guy did is he took a coil. He found a couple of frequencies that shake things at a subatomic level that cause an exorbitant amount of gas to be released. And the more energy you use to create this frequency, the less efficiency you get. The less energy you use, the more efficiency you get. And it just got really strange, but it worked. And so instead of sitting around mulling around the calculations of how impossible it might be, what we did is we built it. We just built it from the ground up, part by part, component by component. Sometimes that tends to be a little expensive because you're trying to reverse engineer technology that you really don't have all the knowledge of, so you're really doing the best you can, and you have a lot of problems along the way, but these problems lead to a lot of really interesting solutions internally with you and your team, because now as you're coming up to all these problems, you realize what Bob probably had to do over the course of 20 years of developing this technology, because he gave us basically a great recipe book on how to reduplicate his bubbler system for hydrogen boosting an engine to get better efficiency. What he didn't disclose is how powerful it really is. I mean, really powerful, like off the scale powerful. So right now, if you were to actually run the numbers based on what we're getting about 300 to 400% over what we should be getting over standard electrolysis, which means that we put a gallon of water in, we can run a car. If we were using standard electrolysis, we'd have to use a lot more energy, 10 times the amount of energy, to get the amount of hydrogen out to run the engine. So he's created a very efficient way to liberate enough hydrogen and oxygen out of a system to keep a car going.
Well, that is something that everyone can look forward to seeing when this film hopefully hits the big screen in every locale around the country and around the world.
We're pushing for it at the end of the year.
So we're talking about something comparable to the 2006 film Who Killed the Electric Car, but in this case, hopefully, the introduction of the water car into the mainstream consciousness.
Well, we're hoping a little bit more than that. Actually, use the right term there, hopefully. What we're doing in this film that we think is a little more unique compared to what other films are doing is we're a solution-based film. There isn't a problem that we're not presenting in this film that we don't have an answer to. So instead of just presenting water cars, we're presenting probably 10 to 15 technologies around the planet that the average public doesn't know exists. Plasma technologies for reducing waste, other advanced methods of boosting your fuel economy using different hydrogen bubbling systems, and we're testing them all for you so you don't have to do the guesswork. We're buying all of them. We're testing all of them. So as you check through the Internet, you're looking through bubblers. It's hard to discern which ones are good and which ones are bad. So a lot of times, you know, what we were trying to do is try to figure out, well, which ones are good and which ones are bad. Well, it's impossible to know based on the website, so we've just bought them all, and we're testing all of them, and we've got them on dynos, we've got them on, we're doing emissions tests on every vehicle before and after, so we're getting our own baseline for these things. We're not taking anyone's word for anything. And again, this is a film about real technologies that currently exist, that are obtainable to you and are affordable, that you don't have to wait for somebody to deliver to you. If you do your homework, you'll be able to find them online and piece them together yourself. And if you can't get it pieced together yourself, hopefully you can hand the plans off to a mechanic and he can pound the thing together for you. And what we'll be doing is not only loosening our dependence on foreign oil, which I think it's just a necessity, but we're also at the same time boosting our own fuel economy, whatever fuel we may end up using, and we're reducing emissions, so we're saving the environment. So it's a win-win.
Absolutely. Now, what about the economy? People express concern about it. There's even been some threats to inventors associated with the economic chaos that they say will result from the introduction of free energy technology. What do you think of that kind of...
I think it's rhetoric, and I got to tell you why. Because, you know, I love these economic models that can demonstrate complete and utter chaos. I mean, I'm looking at these, and I've seen them for years, and it's the same thing that's been around since the 1920s. If we were to stop using gasoline tomorrow and introduce water as a fuel, it would change the economy completely, and it would cripple these jobs and this and that. No, that's nonsense. What you're doing is you're creating a new economy. You have to evolve out of a stale economy, no matter what. You have to evolve out of old technologies. So instead of thinking it as a revolution, you have to think of it as an evolution of economy. So if your stock depends on oil being $85 a barrel, then yeah, you know what? The introduction of a water car or a gravity motor that's self-sustaining or anything of that ilk is going to scare you because you know what? You may not be able to get that extra acre on that ranch this year. But as far as the rest of the planet goes, we've got to raise our level of responsibility up a little bit. So the economic models that I keep seeing that it will cause a global crash if we switch over from these economies, not only is unlikely, but that's assuming that we were to do a 24-hour switch, which is impossible. We'd have to phase these technology in over 5 to 10 years anyway. And just like they're doing right now, and the buzzword in BP, you see BP advertisements for it everywhere, and Exxon advertisements for it, is hydrogen. And about 2 years ago, the oil companies got together and realized, you know what? Oh, the Middle East is strangling us a little bit here, and a couple Nigerians decided that they were going to stop selling oil to the United States just because they didn't like the price. So maybe we don't have as much control over there, even though we've started this war. So maybe we should start playing along a little bit and start looking towards this hydrogen future. Let's start dropping some nice earth-friendly ads into all the popular science magazines and letting everybody know that that's where we're gearing towards. We're right behind you, folks. Now, that keeps one foot out there in that economy that's going to shift everything. But at the same time, they still have their bets are still placed on all the oil. They're just hoping that they can liquidate that asset before they actually have to switch over to this proposed hydrogen economy, hydrogen fuel system that they're promoting in these ad campaigns.
It's all about delay, isn't it?
It's all about delay. You got to use the asset while you have it, and they're going to liquidate it. They're not going to switch over to hydrogen right now if they still got enough of 60. If they still have 60 years worth of assets to sell, each year charging $10 more per barrel. They're going to keep pushing that thing until we're at $10 a gallon. They'll do it because they know that people will do it.
No corporation is going to have as its motto, we're going to teach you how to make your own clean energy at home.
That's right.
Under the hood.
That would be terrible business. And you know what? I would not buy stock in a company that worked on that sort of principle either, and neither would you. So, you know, they have a mandate, and their mandate is to make money. Their mandate is not to provide a clean, form of fuel for you and I to get back and forth to school or work in. It was never their mandate. Their mandate was mine it, sell it. And they do that really, really well. What happened later on is, you know, after the 40s and after the 50s, when people started realizing, well, we could be choking to death from this stuff, and there may not be an infinite amount of this stuff, then there started these moral obligations started coming in there, and they started getting a lot more PR-oriented towards making it sound like they were working towards a cleaner economy by making fuel cleaner and helping car companies work towards a cleaner engine and cleaner systems, and we'll take less lead out, but we'll replace it with this other horrible MTMB, which will work its way into the water supply around the planet and retard an entire generation of humans.
The more I think about it, considering that a hydrogen booster that cleans up exhaust was patented in 1918,
yeah.
It almost seems demonic. The course that these companies have taken
yeah.
is worse than what any... Hitler or any other kind of demented human would do. It's just awful.
It's a combination of stupid, sadistic. What's really interesting is you know you could sit here and ponder all day long the politics of a global economy, because it comes down to money, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that a lot of big companies run the show, and the banks run those companies, and the insurance companies run those banks. And there's a few policymakers that run those insurance companies. So banks can't cut checks unless they're insurable. So at the top of the food chain, you have these big insurance companies behind the banks that are telling the banks which companies to loan money to. Those companies every other year are going bankrupt because they've outlived their usefulness. Like, I hate to say American automobile manufacturers, but you know, they're choking to death right now because they just can't figure out why they had such a great surge in economy selling these SUVs, and suddenly when gas is, you know, $3 a gallon, that they're going bankrupt and they're asking the government to help bail them out again. When they should have, back in the late 60s or you know early 50s, already started moving towards a hydrogen boosted vehicle, or a pure hydrogen vehicle, or a water vehicle, or a solar energy vehicle, or a magnetic motor, whatever.
Or even a Pogue carburetor vehicle.
Pogue carburetor. I mean, that was right on the books, and the average public doesn't even know that, you know, the government seized a carburetor in the early 1940s from a Canadian inventor who came out and showed that he could get, what, 248 miles per gallon?
Something like 200 miles per gallon on a vehicle at that time, which, of course, we have bigger engines and so on today. But it's still, it translates to tremendous increase in mileage and decrease in exhaust emissions.
Oh, absolutely. It was a remarkable, remarkable retooling of a carburetor, basically. And he had a vaporization system in there and a platinum screen, and it was doing some really interesting stuff. And basically, the military came in and said, hey, you know, these would be really great on our tanks. We should use them over there in Germany. So they seized it, put it under a military clamp. They gave the guy he ended up becoming a president of an oil company, I think, in Canada, or the president of a company in Canada.
Yeah, I think they were. He was offered a position in an auto parts warehousing type.
Yeah,
he manufactured air filters or something.
Yeah, he was broke, and now he had money, and he was in a position of power, and he kept his mouth shut because it was wartime, and that's what you did. They took his carburetor, they put it on our tanks. Our tanks suddenly became more efficient. Canadian tanks became more efficient. Eventually we win the war, and they don't give him his technology back, and they kept a military clamp on this thing until basically he was dead, and there was no way for anybody to collect on it or sue for it. And then they reformulate the gas every 5 years, so you can't use anything like a vaporization.
Yeah, so you can't crack it like you could back then.
Yeah, exactly. So you could never quite use the old Pogue carburetor today because gas has been reformulated so many times and lead's been changed.
Now, I hate to interrupt you, but we're running short on time, and I wanted you to share some of the good things that you saw on a recent trip to Japan. You went, 2 months ago?
I went in January, mid-January.
Uh-huh.
And I met with a gentleman named Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu. And this boy is a big dog in Japan. He's got 5 PhDs. He co-started the Tokyo Engineering School. He's in his 80s. He holds the patent for the IBM hard drive, 1952.
In fact, it says here on the Internet that he holds over 3,000 patents, times as many as Edison.
He does. He has 3,000 patents to his name. He does. He outweighs Edison. Right now, he's considered the greatest living patented inventor.
Like the floppy disk, huh?
Yep, the floppy disk, the hard drive. I mean, I was at his house. I saw Seagate drives for hard disk modification. I mean, this guy is way ahead of the curve. Now, here's what he did. He's a real environmentalist himself. And Japan, as you know, is always – Japan and Asia in general are stressing environmental technologies because there's a lack of resources. So what he did 2 years ago and he's got quite a bit of money. He didn't have to ask anybody's permission to do this. He built himself a $30 million prototype home smack dab in the middle of Tokyo. It's off the grid. Provides 30,000 kilowatts. There isn't a solar panel or a windmill anywhere in sight.
Wow. So how's he doing it?
He's built himself a Tesla radiant antenna wall on the outside of his house. It's one whole wall that also acts as a thermal coupler. So when the sun hits it, it's a black wall. It converts a lot of that heat energy and uses a special composite of metals and converts that into electricity and transfers that into his home. And on the inside of his home, you've got a couple of really unique water systems. One is this super high-pressure heater that he built during World War II. Because there was a real clampdown on kerosene in Japan during the war, so there wasn't a lot of fuel to heat your home. So he was studying up a little bit on pressure systems and pumps, and he found a really unique way with a small amount of energy to pressurize water to high pressure and heat it with high pressure, and then he would pipe that into his home into what we now call radiant floors. And he's been doing this since apparently the 40s. So you go into his home, and he's got this heater that just takes a couple of watts but heats all the water in his house, doesn't use fuel, uses a minimal amount of electricity, and provides all the hot water for a seven-story estate.
Wow.
And downstairs, here's the best part, in his garage, in his secret laboratory, what attracted me to go over there and talk to him was I heard a rumor that this guy had received a hydrogen on-demand patent. So I checked on it, and it was true, but I didn't believe it. So I went to Japan to check it out.
And this patent goes back how far?
1996.
Okay.
So it was a wild claim, and it seemed, I had my doubts about it because the patent to me looked like a combination of a few other patents that are actually in your book. So when I went to investigate it, what I found out is he's got a very unique, very smart approach to hydrogen on demand. It's a little bit different than what we were trying over here for the film and what I've seen in the States. Most people over here are doing their hydrogen on demand systems by filling a tank full of water, using a special form of electrolysis to break enough hydrogen and oxygen into a usable fuel. What he's done is he's got a similar system, but he's got a Coke can size container of water that he blasts into hydrogen and oxygen with electricity at a high voltage, low amperage. Very unique, and he super pressurizes it. It goes into a custom-designed fuel cell, which runs an electric motor. So I drove a hydrogen-on-demand fuel cell-driven electric motorcycle through Tokyo with
wow.
Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu.
Amazing. And the energy to perform the electrolysis on the water to provide the hydrogen for the fuel cell is coming from the battery of the vehicle?
Just a little battery that came inside of a little scooter.
Which gets recharged by the movement of the vehicle?
Correct. The movement of the vehicle keeps it charged. The electric motor is providing enough power to keep the battery charged.
So it is self-sustaining?
Self-sustaining.
And uses ordinary water, or does he add anything to it? Or?
No, this guy takes it right out of the tap. We don't have to use distilled. There's no chemicals, nothing. And that to him was the piece de resistance, because he was keeping an eye on what Stan Meyer and others were doing, and he noticed that everybody was using chemical electrolyzers to enhance the electroconductivity of water. He thought, if there's a way for people just to use tap water, pour it into a canister, close it, turn on your engine, and blast that water apart with frequencies and high voltage, you'd get a Brown's gas type of fuel that you could use in a specially designed fuel cell that he custom built, and he's going to be bringing that onto the market very shortly, and drive around in his own custom-made electric motor as well. Now, what he's doing, I hope I'm not stepping out of bounds by saying this, when I was with him, he's already working with Mazda and Lexus on introducing a hydrogen-on-demand vehicle. And you know what's really interesting? They love him over there for it. There's no resistance to inventors in Japan for making claims on free energy, alternative energy, ambient energy, or hydrogen on demand. They'll throw you a ticker tape parade.
Well, seeing that they don't have any fossil fuels on their islands, I suppose that's a great incentive for such a...
Yeah, they'll name a street after you if you bring something over there that's even slightly efficient.
And yet we do take note of the fact that it was in 1996 that he patented this technology. So here over 10 years have passed, and we're still talking about the possibility of it being introduced.
Isn't it? Well, not only that, we're talking about the possibility that it's real.
Yeah.
And not only that, I mean, you and I are kind of, you know, you and I have been doing this for a while, and the average person out there who might be listening in on this thing is still nodding their head saying, well, if it's true, I would have seen it.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. It's true. It's been true for a long time. There's economic reasons you haven't seen it. It's not because it's scientifically impossible. It's out there.
Yeah. And speaking of other people listening, I would like to invite Larry to go ahead and call in if he's available, and have him comment on the GEAT system that he did.
That'd be great.
So you came back from Japan, though, pretty stoked about what you'd seen, huh?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I mean, a $30 million mansion in the middle of Tokyo, I mean, smack in the middle of Tokyo, in the really expensive district, off the grid, no solar, no wind, self-sustaining, providing power to the neighborhood, recycling a lot of its own water, using this super efficient heater that I've never seen before in my life. I hadn't even thought about heating water under pressure like this before with low energy and low voltage. Now, what was really nice is Dr. Yoshio Nakamatsu has got a great sense of humor, and he loves Americans, and he understands that we're really trying to get these kind of technologies brought over, and he sympathizes. So he was willing to work out an alliance where we're going to be bringing a Dr. Nakamatsu home, and we're going to be building it for less than $300,000 here in the States, fitted with all the same technology that's in his home in Japan.
Wow. Okay, it looks like we've got Larry with. Let me click him on here and see if this isn't him. Larry, is that you? Hello? Let's try again here. Well, let's see here now. Larry, are you there?
James, are we connected?
Yes, we sure are.
Fantastic. Now, am I your first caller?
You're the first person to call into this show, our third show.
Well, then I win the water car, right?
Chris, you have anything to, maybe a T-shirt or something?
a good hearty handshake.
Well, that's fine. That's a good thing.
So, Larry, do you want to tell us about your GEAT experience?
Oh, I'd be happy to. First, a little background on myself. I guess my name is Larry Jarbo. I go by the name The Baseman on the forums. But I'm a county commissioner in Maryland, St. Mary's County, and drive a electric car that we built, and we race that. It holds a National Electric Drag Racing Association records. We work with a high school, and we did that. And some years ago, I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, I built a GEAT, and I use it on a trailer, and we actually trailer it behind the electric car, and then we power the electric car for extended range using the GEAT. So
that's great.
Yeah, it really shows well, if you know what I'm saying.
I love it, man.
So, in fact, I think if you do baynet.com maybe, baynet.org, one or the other, or no, it's thebaynet.com. So it's all one word, thebaynet. Maybe in their archives they've got a picture of it. So I'm on the Internet. If you look up Larry Jarbo, capital M-R, and then the number 2, MR2, because that's what the car is, a Toyota.
Oh, great.
And but anyway, you know, I built the GEAT, and it works like Mr. Pantone says. It's gets at least twice the fuel economy and burns very clean. I take it to shows, and people see it. You know, I've made the bubbler, so it's clear. Made it out of a clear PVC, and as a result, people can see the whole process taking place. And sometimes I'll take some water and add to the mix, or you know, if somebody's got a soda, we'll just throw a soda in there, or whatever. And people are amazed because if you did that to your car, you'd be in a world of trouble.
So, what's your take on what it's doing? Is it breaking it down into its constituent gases, or?
Well, I maintain, now my theory is, and I guess, you know, we've heard there's 60 different theories, my theory is it's a cracking carburetor is what it is.
Okay.
Very similar to the process that the Pogue carburetor had. The bubbler taps off the aromatic hydrocarbons, so you can have hydrocarbons of, you know, regular gasoline. You can throw diesel fuel into it, but you still need some gasoline or minerals. You can run mineral spirits. I use mostly naphtha gas is what I use. I've got a source for a source of gas. It's a very pure gas. Doesn't have all the additives. And that way I don't have the problem with having to adjust it all the time. I don't know if you've ever noticed how if you mix it with water and gasoline, as the volatiles, you know, are seeped off, you'll find you have to change the air mix a little bit. Otherwise, it tends to lean itself out too much.
Okay. I've got bad news. Our time is just about up. In fact, we're we're in our last minute. So, Larry, first of all, I want to thank you for having joined us.
Oh, no problem.
I want to say goodbye to Chris here. But thanks for coming in. I hope you call back.
Well, Chris, and I really appreciate the whole webcast. That it was fascinating, and I'm going to be reviewing it, and I hope other people will as well.
I do too. Thank you very much for having us on, James. This has been a very great experience.
Okay, Chris, you can stay with us for another second or so. But yeah, I look forward to seeing the full body of your work presented in this film that is yet to come to fruition. I hope that people all over the world can benefit from it.
I hope so, too.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks again for tuning in to this third broadcast from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. And I hope that the information that's been presented here has encouraged you to pursue the investigation and the implementation of these technologies for your own good and for the good of this planet. Thanks again. Have a good evening.